Major funding for this Public Radio International program is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support from the Colomb Foundation, the Compton Foundation, and the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Until it's acknowledged, until the truth can come out, there can't really be that kind of reconciliation. People can bury things and they can decide to go on with their lives and deal, but it's not a rebuilding of a community or a reconciliation.
Do war crimes trials in a UN court offer an alternative to war? You're listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. The rule of law is civilization's attempt to improve upon mob rule, eye for an eye vengeance, and the tendency of the powerful to trample the weak. At its best, the forum of a courtroom provides a calm search for truth and justice, a scene that is practically the opposite of a military battlefield dominated by brute force. And so the overlapping of these two spheres, the legal system and warfare, was a fascinating development of the 20th century. Although laws aimed at restraining war were promulgated in some ancient societies, a new era began with the Nuremberg and Tokyo trials following World War II, and continues today in The Hague.
All rise for your full of eight. The International Criminal Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia is now in session. L'audience Tribunal Penal International pour l'ex-Yugoslavie est ouverte. Please be seated.
The atrocities committed in the Balkans starting in 1991 claimed nearly a quarter million lives in a bloody clash involving the Serb, Croat, and Bosnian Muslim peoples. A savage practice that came to be known as ethnic cleansing produced mass graves and concentration camps and the rape of some 10,000 women. The attacks on civilians so horrified the world community that the United Nations, with substantial support by the United States, established a special court in 1993 to put the perpetrators on trial for violating international human rights laws. In 1999, when 750,000 ethnic Albanians were driven from their homes in the Kosovo region of Yugoslavia, the prosecutor brought additional charges.
The following accused are jointly indicted: Slobodan Milosevic, President of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia; Milan Milutinovic, President of the Republic of Serbia.
Although a daring legal maneuver made while NATO bombers pounded the Serbian army, the indictment of the Serb leader Slobodan Milosevic may have seemed mostly symbolic. But 2 years later, after being forced from power and subsequently arrested by local authorities, there was a stunning development in June 2001. Yugoslav's new prime minister yielded to international pressure and the enticement of an aid package worth billions and ordered police to spirit Milosevic to an American air base in Bosnia, where he was flown to the Netherlands for trial. This is the courtroom lobby in The Hague, a short train ride south from the Dutch capital of Amsterdam. An envelope of UN security officers surrounds Milosevic when he is brought to court each day from nearby Scheveningen prison. His trial, which will take years, began here in February 2002 and now encompasses 66 charges of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide.
Okružnog suda u Kopru, Helsinškog monitora Slovenije.
Milosevic, who denies the tribunal's legitimacy, has refused to be represented by lawyers and defends himself, speaking in his native Serbo-Croatian.
Predsjednik Helsinškog odbora Slovenije, imam dokumenta veća država.
He was a world leader who wielded power for 14 years, at one time as Yugoslavia's Communist Party chief and later as head of state. Now white-haired and trim in his 60s, Milosevic is wearing a blue suit and red tie in court and leafs through a mountain of documents, always with a uniformed guard at his side. The source of his information is unknown. Some suspect he relies on material once collected by the secret police. the prosecutor, Jeffrey Nice, an Englishman, addresses a male witness.
For the duration of these proceedings, you will be known as witness B1070. Will you look, please, at this document, which is tab 1 of Exhibit 450, and confirm by saying yes, if it be the case, that that is your proper name?
Because witnesses and their families have been threatened, many of those testifying appear in court under protected status without revealing their names aloud. A screen descends, hiding the person from public view. The witness's face and voice are electronically scrambled on the video feed of court hearings, which is available worldwide. Here the prosecutor summarizes for the judges a written statement provided by witness 1070, a Muslim man from the Yugoslav municipality of Bratunac. It alleges actions in 1992 by Serbian soldiers and paramilitary forces.
On the 10th of May, the witness and his family were forced from their home at gunpoint, taken to the stadium in Bratunac, and there were more than 3,000 people, men, women, and children, gathered in the stadium. Muslims were told to hand in identification documents, money, gold, and valuables, and threatened that anybody who declined to do so would be killed. The women and children, elderly and young, were loaded into buses and trucks. The men were taken on foot in columns to the local gymnasium at the Vuk Karadzic school, marked, as the chamber can see, on the photograph. That male group increased over the next few days by about a further 300, bringing the total population to about 1,000. Of that 1,000, the witnesses' statements reveal in horrifying detail, the majority were killed. Only 401 survived the next 3 days of killings. The conditions inside the hangar were appalling, terrifying. Included in the details he gives in his statement is of a man who was obliged by the captors to choose between which of his two sons present there with him should be shot. The man unable to make that decision, all three of them were shot in consequence.
A three-judge panel presides attentively over the trial chamber, donning black gowns with a red sash. The judges are all men, a Jamaican, a Korean, and the presiding judge, a hard-working, sometimes irritable Englishman, Richard May. After sitting through more than a year of graphic testimony, their faces betray little emotion, even as atrocities are painfully described. In his defense, Mr. Milosevic tries to discredit witnesses against him and to assert over and over that it was the Serbian people who suffered the greatest persecution in Yugoslavia. Although his constituency there has dwindled, and many of the criminal gangs Milosevic once consorted with are now in jail, his courtroom speeches largely play to the audience back home. Through a translator, he addresses the court.
The army and the police defended their own country with honor and chivalry. Individuals and groups that may commit crimes exist anywhere in the world and are condemned and prosecuted everywhere. Such dirty crimes cannot be ascribed to an army, a police, a people, a nation, a country, their government.
It was a time of upheaval and transition with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of communism throughout Eastern Europe.
Judith Armata, an American lawyer, attends court each day as an observer for the Coalition for International Justice based in Washington. She has spent years documenting war crimes in the Balkans.
All of the countries were in upheaval, which means that power then becomes available in some ways. It isn't in a strictly institutional channel anymore. And it tends to bring to the fore people who want power and may not, you know, want anything besides that. I think it provided the opportunity for people who wanted power, like Milosevic, to come forward.
A driving force of the tragedy in Yugoslavia was a culture of fanatical ethnic chauvinism that pitted neighbors against each other. Over the centuries, the rivalry there between Serbs and Muslims has at times flared into fierce violence. Tensions in the region ignited World War I. In the 1990s, the flames of hatred were again fanned by ethnic leaders.
Some people in a time of upheaval are they're looking for an identity again. They're not part of the Brotherhood and Unity Yugoslav community that they always have been. And things are unstable, the economy is bad. And then, of course, the use of propaganda.
We had at least five years of preparation for those crimes, from the official media, from the politicians, from the academics, from the writers.
Mirko Klarin is a journalist from Yugoslavia. In the early 1990s, as an editorial writer for a newspaper in Belgrade, he called for war crimes trials before the worst violence erupted. His plea fell on deaf ears. Today he works in The Hague, producing a weekly Yugoslav television report on events at the tribunal. He says the ethnic warfare resulted from a calculated campaign.
They tried to provoke fear, prejudice, hatred, you know, all negative emotions which exist, I mean, in more or less the same measure in every nation, but the responsibility of the, you know, responsible politicians, responsible media are to suppress those negative emotions, you know. But we have had a nuclear reactor of those emotions for 5 years, exactly to prepare the ground for the crimes, to lower the threshold, you know, just our media in former Yugoslavia, not only Serbian media, I would say, their message was not go and kill them. Their message was they are coming to kill you. The result was just the same, you know. It was planned. Of course, it was intentional, with clear territorial goals, you know. But the people have been used, and especially the fear was the great motivating force for the crimes.
Predsjednica Neva Miklavčić Predan, predsjednik Helsinškog odbora Slovenije.
Today, Mr. Milosevic speaks mostly in the calm tones befitting a serious trial. But the Balkan cauldron was stirred up when he and other ambitious leaders rose to power by vilifying a feared group. It followed the same pattern as in the Nazi Holocaust, the massacre in Rwanda, and numerous other crimes of ethnic hatred. For journalist Judith Armada, the lesson is to remain on guard against the tendency to proclaim a whole group as enemies.
There are always different things, whether it's race or it's sexual preference or nationality or religion. You know, those things can be exploited. And in times of insecurity, for example, right now, there's a lot of insecurity in the world, and there's fear of terrorism. And it's very easy to kind of create a situation where you say that all Arabs or anybody from that background or all Muslims are terrorists. And those sorts of situations, I think, are where there's a fear, where there's insecurity, and then when you start stereotyping groups of people and separating them out so that they're not part of our human community.
The us against them syndrome?
The us, absolutely, the us against them. Anytime that's done, I mean, we do tend to generalize. We're a people that, human beings seem to be a people that generalize, that it helps us, you know, we categorize and generalize so we can make sense of the world. And that's wonderful, except that we also really have to remember that that's a limited vision and it's not the whole story. And we do share a common humanity.
it was very difficult to convince the Western world that crimes such as those committed in former Yugoslavia were happening at the end of the 20th century.
Florence Hartmann serves as spokesperson for the Office of the Prosecutor at the Yugoslav Tribunal. Formerly, she was a reporter covering Yugoslavia for the French newspaper Le Monde.
I was investigating and I found the first mass grave in the former Yugoslavia, the one of Ovčara, with another colleague, and it was the only way to write there is mass graves in the former Yugoslavia. And it was so shocking that my chief editor put quote-unquote on mass graves, even if I was there and I saw the bodies.
So here we are in the headquarters of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and also for Rwanda. How do you define the purpose of an international criminal trial?
Well, is that, well, there is no impunity, no immunity, and that even if we take Slobodan Milosevic, even a head of state can be put before his judge and will be held accountable. But what is more concretely important is that it's also that the public will acknowledge what happened in the region, that the world will know what happened, but especially the local people in the former Yugoslavia will be able to know what was established, what happened, because nobody knows exactly what happened. The victim knows what happened to them, but the other side, which was supporting those who committed the crimes, are denying the crimes. Then all those trials are important against the denial. And fighting against denial and admitting what happened is the first step for reconciliation. There is no reconciliation without admitting the facts. And especially in the former Yugoslavia, where even what happened during the Second World War was not established and was hide and was one of the elements which will feed the hatred will bring again the war 50 years later. And it's very important to establish what happened.
To prevent a recurrence 50 years from now.
Absolutely.
Water splashing from a fountain near the entrance of the tan brick building, which houses the Yugoslav Tribunal here in The Hague. This relaxing scene suggests little of the intense drama of justice being enacted at the war crimes trials occurring inside.
I think I've been most moved by some of the survivors who've been willing to come up and give their testimony.
Judith Armada.
We started in the Kosovo case where a number of people who came to testify were peasants. They lived in villages in Kosovo in almost a different time period and came before one of the most important courts in the world to give their testimony. They were outside their community, so they didn't have that kind of support, and they were able to stand up to the man that they held responsible and tell him, without even an attorney mediating, because he's representing himself, but to tell their truth in front of him. And those were incredibly moving experiences. I remember one in particular, this elderly man who was illiterate, and he talked about his adult son coming over one morning completely distraught and in tears and saying, my family has just been killed. I have no reason to live. So his father went with him and back to the home, and his wife and children had been shot and killed by the Serbian forces. You know, he was able to, he got out, his son got out, they lost everything and many, many relatives. But what he came to testify, and Milosevic challenged him one way or another, and he was what I called, you know, sort of the voice of God. Here is this elderly man who's very slight, and his voice was so powerful, and he turned to Milosevic, and he said, I actually have a question for you. I just want to know, don't you have any feelings? How can you do this to women and children? And there was, usually the judge sort of says, you know, it's not for you to ask questions, and this sort of thing. There was complete silence in the courtroom, and nothing happened. Milosevic, of course, didn't respond to that at all. But it was incredibly moving, and it was an opportunity for somebody, to see the power of an individual and just that individual power to stand up to this incredible evil. In some ways, it was very moving.
He had his day in court.
He had his day in court, and others had their day in court because of him, because he was able to do that. He stood up to the man who had primary responsibility for them losing their homes and their families and their friends and their way of life, and saying to him, you know, you are responsible, you are a human being, and how could you? How can you do that? The question that we all wonder, how can you do that? You know, how can you kill a baby?
A sober legal proceeding, with its strict rules of evidence and a fair opportunity to cross-examine witnesses, creates a unique forum for establishing the facts and compiling a trustworthy record of events for history. But prosecutors are mindful that in subjecting an atrocity witness to the rigors of a courtroom, they run the risk of re-traumatizing someone who has already suffered. Patricia Sellers, an American attorney, serves in the prosecutor's office at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, where she has specialized in cases involving sexual violence.
To a certain extent, what we have found with witnesses, including sexual assault witnesses, is they get stronger on the stand. They realize that the reason I'm here is because you're being accused. So for some, it does have a bit of I certainly wouldn't go as far as saying therapeutic, but one knows that when you can finally confront someone who has made you suffer, that that at times can be a step toward a bit of personal reconciliation. But prior to testifying, people prepare themselves, and then you relive the horror.
Well, you think there may be an element of catharsis in it?
Yes. Yes, I do. There have been too many people who have come off the stand at least momentarily feeling better, feeling stronger.
Because they were able to look in the eye a person who had perpetrated something awful.
That. I think it's that the court was listening to them tell their story. Everyone now was concerned about what you have to say. And you were told only to speak the truth, and that's what I'm speaking. Someone has to know.
Another very powerful instance for me was when a young soldier came forward. He was he served in Milosevic's army. He'd been conscripted, was 20 years old at the time, and forced into this situation where he's shooting people he doesn't, you know, civilians. And he was ordered with some of his maybe three other soldiers, to shoot a group of people, maybe 8 or 10 of them. All civilians, women and children, and one included a baby. And he did. He shot him. And he killed the baby. And he said, he actually came forward. He called the prosecutor up and said, I want to testify. And he said, I did this. I carry this with me. I have had not one night of sleep since that happened. I always hear that baby screaming. And, you know, and he was also able to turn to Milosevic and said, you did this. And you did this to me, and you did it to those babies, you did it to those people, and you need to be held responsible. Now, that, to me, justifies the whole process.
And was there any visible reaction by Milosevic, any recognition that he bears culpability for those actions?
None. None. No.
Is he a man utterly without remorse as far as anyone can see from the outside?
He will occasionally say something to a witness, and maybe has said it 3 or 4 times in the whole case. No one can justify what happened to you. It's very tragic. But as far as personal responsibility for that or seeing any connection with him, no. No, he's completely able to, at least visibly, to keep that away from him.
The funny thing is that as I sit there in the courtroom and watch his body language and watch the intelligence with which he goes through the evidence and picks out weak points. You don't get the feeling from his personal demeanor that he's ruthless, and yet the accounts of everything he's done are absolutely the most horrific thing you could possibly imagine. What sort of a man do you see him as?
It's a very difficult question. I mean, this is really the question which should be put to some psychiatrist.
Yugoslav television journalist Mirko Klarin.
So he can completely, you know, create another reality, you know, in which he really believes, you know, and how he can be convincing when he presents that reality out to other people, you know, that's exactly what you described now, you know, just. But sometimes you have a real impression that this man doesn't know where he is and where he lives, you know, and what's happening around him, you know.
That he's in a sort of a fantasy?
He lived, very secluded life with his family. I mean, he's a man who is very much attached to especially to his wife and his kids. And they just create their own world, you know. And now he's trying to sell that world to the wider public and to the judges.
As a mechanism for justice, the Yugoslav Tribunal is widely viewed as a work in progress. Some trial observers have criticized the court's decision to permit Milosevic to defend himself, both because he makes key legal mistakes, they say, and because he uses the trial for grandstanding. Another limitation is that several major defendants remain at large, and so to date the tribunal's task is incomplete. But the big fish, Slobodan Milosevic, has indeed been hauled into court. The verdict largely will turn on whether the Balkan bloodbath of the 1990s can be linked directly to his command. But the trial itself dramatizes a fundamental principle, that no one, no matter how powerful or frightening, is above the law. You're listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Steve Colby. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Mulberry Studio. Music performed by Brad Hatfield. Our program is presented by Human Media, in association with The Network Incorporated. Program development and support provided by Chart Media.
We're distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. If you'd like to purchase a cassette copy of Humankind by phone, please call toll-free 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-L-I-S-T-E-N. To learn more about this and our other programs and to hear selected episodes online or to order tapes online, check our website, humanmedia.org. That's humanmedia.org. We'll give that again in a moment. Major funding for this program is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the Colomb Foundation, the Compton Foundation, and from this station and the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Again, for tapes of Humankind, call 1-800-5-LISTEN, and our web address is humanmedia.org.
This segment of Beyond War is Humankind program number 67 from PRI, Public Radio International.